In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, for those of you who are visiting, why have I chosen this passage? We are in a series of lessons working our way through 1 Corinthians. And we have now made our way to chapter 7, what we call chapter 7. And I want you to notice in the first part of verse 1, chapter 7, Paul says, "Now for the matters you write about." We are now making a shift in this letter. Prior to this passage, Paul has been dealing with a number of issues that were verbally reported to him, we believe, by three men who were visiting Paul from Corinth. And those names are listed in chapter 16 and verse 17, and we won't look into that. You can look at that yourself later. But for the first part of this letter, Paul has been responding to issues those individuals reported to him. Now, they also, when they came to visit Paul, brought him a letter. And in that letter, they apparently raised other issues and questions. And beginning here, in what we call chapter 7, Paul now begins to respond to those issues, to those questions, which puts us at somewhat of a dilemma in that we don't have the letter they wrote to him with those questions. So we're trying to piece together their questions based upon how Paul responds to those questions, which is a little bit of a challenge to us. It would be nice to know what their specific questions were, but we don't have that letter. What we have is Paul's response to that letter. And based upon his responses in the remainder of this letter, it looks like their questions revolved around issues like what we're going to look at today, personal relationships. Chapter 7, food sacrificed to idols, chapter 8, 9, and 10, problems they were having in the assembly that Paul addresses in chapters 11, 12, 13, and 14, questions they had about the resurrection, which Paul addresses in chapter 15, and then questions or problems they had about this collection that was being taken up for the Christians in Judea, which Paul deals with in chapter 16. So, we don't know what their specific questions were, but from Paul's responses, we gather at least a general idea of what the main issues they were having were. Up today is in chapter 7, they appear to have had questions about singleness, divorce, marriage, questions about personal relationships. And Paul's going to respond to that throughout this rather lengthy chapter. Perhaps they asked questions like, what should single people do? Maybe they asked questions like, what should those who are single again do? Remember, you've got a lot of people in this church who were coming out of a very immoral, very pagan background. Many of them weren't used to this idea of one man, one woman for life. That was new. And so they're having to learn what it means to be a Christian, what it means to follow Christ, what it means to believe in one God and what that one God expects from His people. So they're coming into this out of a very foreign background to that, and they've got a lot of questions about what does it mean to be a single Christian? What does it mean to be a married Christian? What does it mean to be a Christian who's married to an unbeliever? What does it mean to be a Christian whose spouse has died? What about all these questions and these issues we have with how the gospel plays out in our personal relationships? Now, whether their question was one big general question or whether it was several specific questions, we don't know. But throughout this chapter, Paul addresses several subgroups in the church at Corinth. And so what I've done is I've tried to divide Paul's responses into six categories. And if you've got a bulletin today, you'll see an outline there where if you listen closely, I'll give you the answer and you can fill in those blanks regarding these six categories that we're going to look at here for the next few moments this morning. One of them is Paul's preference for the single life. Verses 1 through 7. Let's just go ahead and get these out here and then we'll kind of come back and look at them quickly individually. Number 1, Paul's preference for the single life, verses 1 through 7. Paul's instructions to those who were single again, verses 8 and 9. Paul's instruction to Christian couples, verse 10. Paul's instructions to Christians married to unbelievers, verses 12 through 16. Paul's advice to virgins, verses 25 through 38. And finally, Paul's advice to widows, verses 39 and 40. What I'm going to attempt to do is to quickly look at each of these sections, briefly summarize Paul's instructions to each of these subgroups within the church at Corinth, and then quickly, with what time I've got left, I want to call attention to some of the bigger picture issues that flow out of this text that I think we need to wrestle with and think about in the church today. So, hang with me. But let's try to quickly go through these six different groups that Paul addresses here in chapter 7. Unfortunately, right off the bat, we've got a little bit of a problem. How many of you are using a Pew Bible this morning? Anybody? Doug, you look like you're about it. No, there's a few of you. All right. Our Pew Bibles are the older NIV. If you have an older NIV this morning, or if you're using an electronic Bible of some other sort, you may see something different than what the Bible I'm using this morning has. This is the most recent edition of the NIV, and unfortunately, this creates somewhat of a challenge for the interpreter. The Bible I'm reading from this morning, chapter 7, verse 1, "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." In the Bible I'm using this morning, that's in quotation marks. How many of you are using a Bible this morning that has this verse in quotation marks? All right, kind of only a few of us. I would assume that means the rest of you are using or reading from a Bible this morning that does not have that statement in quotation marks. Am I correct in making that assumption? Okay, as we explored a couple of weeks ago, the Greek language did not come with periods, commas, semicolons, punctuation marks of any kind, including quotation marks. So we've inserted the periods and the commas and the semicolons and the quotation marks. Usually that's not all that hard to do because it's usually pretty obvious, but sometimes it's not. And what we've noticed in our study of 1 Corinthians is it appears, at least in some places, that Paul has a method where he's quoting something the Corinthians were either saying or believed, and then he responds to that. Now, that's kind of a matter of interpretation. The translators have to kind of interpret whether or not they feel Paul is quoting something or whether he's saying something that he himself believes. And so here then is the dilemma for the interpreter, the readers, those of us who are looking at that this morning. Do we see this statement, "It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman," as one, something some of the believers in Corinth believed and were saying? or two, is that something that Paul believed? Okay? Do you see, based upon how you answer that question, that could take you kind of in a different direction, right? I want you to see that. I have to make a decision this morning as to which one of those paths to go down. Is this a slogan that some in Corinth were saying? Were some in Corinth saying, it's better not to be married. It's better not to have sexual relations. Why would some be saying that? Well, it's possible that you had two groups in Corinth. We know there were those who were arguing, do whatever you want with your body. It doesn't matter, right? We talked about that 2 weeks ago. If you want to have sex with someone, it's okay because what you do in your body doesn't matter. Hopefully that rings a bell with you. We talked about that 2 weeks ago. So we know there were some people in Corinth who kind of had that mistaken idea that it really doesn't matter what you do with your body. So some have thought, well, if you've got that at work in Corinth, you might have had some who went all the way to the other side who were saying, well, it's just better not to marry at all. It's just better not to have sex at all. If that's the case, then maybe this was a slogan, a quotation from some in Corinth who actually believed, we're just going to take the high road and say, it's just better off not to get married. It's just better off not to have sex at all. That's possible. Or it might also be that Paul believed it's better to be single. Now, I really don't know, just to be honest with you, which one of those is the best or the right or the correct interpretation. So I'm going to kind of fudge this morning, if you'll let me. And I'm going to suggest to you that whether it was a slogan that they had made up or whether it was something that Paul himself believed, it is at least something that Paul sympathized with. Because throughout this passage, Paul seems to suggest that the single life is preferable. Now, why would Paul believe that? Why would he suggest or believe that the single life is preferable? Well, there are two reasons why that might have been the case. If you look down at verse 26, some have argued that Paul felt the single life was better because there was something going on in Corinth, a crisis of sorts, that single people would have a better time dealing with than married people. In chapter 7 and verse 26, you'll see these words, because of the present crisis, I think it's good for a man to remain as he is. So some think maybe Paul's preference for the single life was based upon whatever this crisis was. There was a crisis going on, and Paul felt because of that crisis, you'd be better off single than married. Some people think the crisis was a famine in the land. We don't really know. Paul doesn't specify what it was. He just says, because of the present crisis, I think it's good for a man to remain as he is. So it does sound like, at least, there's this possibility that because of something going on in the world, something going on in the region, something going on in Corinth at that time, a present crisis of sorts, Paul is kind of leaning in the direction, it's better off for you to be single than it is for you to be married. That's one thing that's going on here. A second thing is many people believe, and I think there's good reason to accept this, some also believe that Paul really had a view that Christ was going to return fairly quickly. And something else that he says here in this verse kind of lends itself toward that belief. Look at verse 29. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not, those who mourn as if they did not, those who are happy as if they were not, those who buy something as if it was not theirs to keep, those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them, for this world in its present form is passing away. That opens the door to the idea, at least, that Paul probably kind of felt, as many did in the first century, Jesus may come back here pretty soon. And so he's encouraging people to live with that view in mind. They were living in a story that had an ending. And that ending was the return of Jesus. And Paul says this world in its present form is passing away. So it's almost like, don't be too worried about all these issues, because it may not play out where it's all that important. And so these two things in Paul's mind seem to heavily color his thinking regarding these matters. One, there's a crisis going on. And Paul thinks because of that crisis, it might be better to be single than married. And secondly, he's not sure, but what the return of Christ is pretty imminent. And if that's the case, a lot of these issues, a lot of these questions, he says, that you have are never really going to materialize anyway. So his basic response to them was, stay as you are. Now, it's better for man not to marry. Whether Paul said that or not, he seems to be in sympathy with it. Because in verse 7, he says, I wish all of you were as I am, indicating that Paul wasn't married. So whether he believed that or believed it because of certain things in play really is kind of beside the point. The main point is this, based on verses 1 through 7. I think Paul says, look, if you're single and celibate and that's the way you want to live, that's great. That's fine. I'm single myself. I wish everybody else was. So if you're single and you're not struggling with sexual immorality, I think Paul would say, that's great. But, he says, if you struggle with issues of sexual immorality, my advice to you is get married. In Paul's understanding, singleness and celibacy was good, but lack of fornication was better. And so Paul's advice is, if you can stay single and be celibate, that's good. In fact, that's preferable in Paul's mind. But he acknowledges not everybody can do that. Most people, he says, need to be married. Because of sexual immorality, he says, every man should have his wife, every wife should have a husband. Paul realizes that most people need to be married so that sexual immorality is not a problem. And so Paul's main advice here in this first section is, if you can be single and celibate, that's good. You'll certainly have more time to devote to the Lord. It's going to be easier on you during this present crisis, whatever it is. So I'm blessing that. That's good. That's honorable. That's preferable. I have no problem with that. If you're single and celibate, that's great. But if you can't do that, if because of sexual immorality, if your passions are too fierce, Paul says, get married. That's okay too. In fact, he even says in the context here, if you're married, don't withhold sexual intimacy from your partner. Don't use it as a weapon. It's a gift from God. Don't withhold it. Your body's not your own. It belongs now to your wife or to your husband as well. So don't withhold sexual intimacy, except, he says, maybe for a very short period of time under mutual consent. But even then, don't make it last very long. Come back together before you're tempted to act out in an unhealthy or immoral way. So that's Paul's opening shot on these questions about personal relationships. Are you single? Paul says, that's good. The celibate lifestyle is honorable. But if you can't do that, get married. That's good too. And by the way, don't withhold sexual intimacy from your partner. All right, let's pick up the pace. The next subgroup he talks about, are those who were single again, verses 8 and 9. Now to the unmarried, the single again, and to the widows. Paul has in mind here, in my opinion, two groups of people. Those who've been made single again, either one by divorce or one by death. The only two ways I know of for someone to be married and then not married are either your spouse died or you divorced and now you're no longer married. So here Paul seems to be addressing within the church at Corinth two groups of people, those whose spouses had died and those who were divorced. And in a divorced culture like they had in ancient Rome and Corinth, it's highly likely that some of the members of that small church in Corinth, either one, had spouses who died, or two, they were divorced from their original spouse. And so Paul says, here's what I want you to do. I prefer that you stay unmarried. I think that's better. But, he says, if you can't, if your passions burn too deep, Paul says, it's okay to remarry. If your spouse has died, I would prefer you stay single. But if you can't, get married. If you're divorced, I would prefer you stay single. But if you can't, get married. It's better to marry, he says, than to burn. Now, some have said that means to burn in hell. I don't think that's what Paul means. I think he means burn with passion. The NIV substitutes that in there. He says it's better to burn with passion. It's better to marry than it is to go around miserable because you're struggling with sexual immorality. Paul says it's better, if that's what you're struggling with, to find a mate. Find a spouse and get married. I would prefer you stay single, but if you need to, get married. Verses 10 and 11, Paul talks to Christian couples. And here he says, to the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord, which I think simply means he's reiterating here what everybody knew the Lord had said. And that was, a wife must not divorce her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. Now, why would this would have been an issue? Possibly because some Christian couples in Corinth were thinking, well, if being single is good, if you have more time to devote to the Lord if you're single, maybe we should get divorced and live the single life. I don't know if that's what was going on or not, but it kind of fits the context of the overall chapter. So maybe you had some Christian couples who were there who were aware of Paul's feelings about preference for the single life, and their question was, we're a married couple, would it be better for us to get divorced and live the single life? To which Paul says, no, it wouldn't be. Scripture very clearly says God hates divorce. Don't divorce your wife. Don't divorce your husband. God's ideal has always been one man, one woman, and one union for life. And so Paul says to the Christians in Corinth, if you're thinking about divorcing your wife, if you're thinking about divorcing your husband, whatever the reason may be, don't do that. Try to work it out. God doesn't want his people divorcing. Now, the next question that Paul addresses is, well, what about a Christian married to an unbeliever? And so Paul has something different to say to that person. Verses 12 through 16. What if I'm married to an unbeliever? To the rest, Paul says, I say, not the Lord, which likely simply means the Lord never directly spoke about this, so Paul's speaking about it. If any brother has a wife who's not a believer, but she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who's not a believer, and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now, that's a loaded text that I'm going to fudge a little bit on and just kind of give you what I think Paul is saying there. Paul is saying, look, if you're married to an unbeliever who's willing to stay with you, stay with them. Don't divorce them. Remember, God hates divorce. Don't divorce them. But also, Paul says, because you will have a sanctifying influence on that home, on that marriage. So if they're willing to stay with you, don't leave. Don't divorce them. maybe you can envision in your mind some of these folks, they were married before they became a Christian. Now they're a Christian and they're married to an unbeliever, and they're thinking, well, is it good for me to be married to an unbeliever? Maybe I should divorce this person. So Paul says, no, if you're married now to an unbeliever, if that unbeliever is willing to stay with you, stay with them. Don't leave. You can have a good influence on that home. We're not talking about salvation here. We're talking about just the blessings of God being poured out on a believer, spilling over into the home and blessing that home. And so Paul says, if you're a believer living with an unbeliever and that unbeliever is willing to stay, stay with them. Be a witness for Christ in that home and bless that home with the Spirit that's within you. But now what about an unbeliever who's not willing to stay? Maybe you've got a Christian in Corinth who's become a Christian. Now the person they were married to doesn't like that. And so they don't want to stay in that relationship anymore. And so the question is, Paul, what do I do? I'm married to an unbeliever who doesn't want to stay married to me. Paul says, if that individual removes himself or herself from your situation, if they don't want to stay married to you and they're hostile about it and there's no peace in the home, Paul says, let them go. You're no longer bound to that person. That covenant has been broken. If there's hostility in that relationship and they're now have animosity towards you now that you've become a Christian and they don't want to stay in that relationship with you because you're serving Christ and they don't like that and they're not at peace with that and they're separating themselves from you, Paul says, let them go. You're no longer bound to that person. Verse 15. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. Yeah, but if I stay with him, maybe I'll change his mind. Maybe I'll influence him to become a Christian. Yeah, but if I keep loving her, if I keep staying with her, maybe she'll eventually become a Christian. Paul says, if there's no peace in that relationship, don't try to force it. Let them go. Verse 16, how do you know, husband, whether you'll save your wife? You don't know that. So don't fight it. If they want to go and they've separated themselves from you and they're not willing to live with you as a believer, Paul says, let them go. In that case, you're no longer bound to that individual. And when we talked about this in our Wednesday night class a couple of weeks ago, I shared with you my understanding of that is that person would then be free to remarry. You're no longer bound to that person. Now, verse 17, hang with me. We're making it. We're getting there. Paul seems to chase a rabbit because he begins to talk about circumcision and slavery. What's he doing? Well, I think he's trying to make a point. Verse 17, nevertheless, each person should live as a believer in whatever situation the Lord has assigned to them, just as God has called them. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commandments is what counts. Each person should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For the one who was a slave when called to faith in the Lord is the Lord's free person. Similarly, the one who is free when called is Christ's slave. Brothers and sisters, each person is responsible to God, should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. What's all of that about? I think Paul's simply making a point. You can be a Christian pretty much anywhere. You can be a Christian in a democracy. You can be a Christian in an anarchy. You can be a Christian in a monarchy. You can be a Christian pretty much anywhere. You can be a Christian if you're a man, woman, child, slave, free, Jew, Gentile. You can be a Christian in a home with an unbeliever. You can be a Christian if you're in a workplace that's not all that good. You can be a Christian pretty much anywhere you find yourself. And Paul's advice here seems to be, wherever you are, Whether your situation is perfect or not, stay where you are. Now, he did say to slaves, if you can gain your freedom, get it. But just remember, even when you become a free man, you're still a slave to Christ. So stay where you are, seems to be Paul's advice. You're in a marriage, stay there. You're married to an unbeliever. Is that unbeliever willing to stay with you? Yes, stay with them. Are you single? Yes. Are you okay? Are you in control of yourself? Are you able to withstand temptation? Yes, then stay where you are. You're fine. Do you need to be married? Are you struggling with sexual immorality? Yes, it's okay. Get married, then stay where you are. So Paul's advice through this seems to be fairly consistent. Okay, real quick, two last subcategories. Paul comes back now to virgins in verse 25 and following. And again, we have a textual problem here. Depending upon what translation you're using, you're going to see very different reading here. In verses 25 through 37, some translations have Paul addressing an individual who is a virgin, who's never been married, and an individual who is engaged to a virgin to be married. Some translations, and you may have one of them this morning, here talks about a father who has a daughter who is a virgin. Are any of you reading from a translation that has that? Anybody? That's surprising because that's usually the other way this is translated. I think the best translation here is Paul is addressing virgins. And his advice is, look, if you're a virgin, if you've never been married, and you're okay where you are, you're not burning with passion, you're all right, stay where you are. And then Paul's other advice is, if you're engaged to a virgin, and you're in control of yourself, stay where you are. But if you're acting dishonorably toward the individual you're engaged to, in other words, if you guys are struggling with sexual immorality, Paul's advice is get married. See, Paul would rather have them stay where they are, probably because of the crisis. He thinks because of that crisis, it'll be better if you're not married. Because as everybody who's married knows, when you're married, you're not just concerned about yourself, you're concerned about your spouse, right? And you're concerned about your children. So if there's a crisis going on, it's better off to be single. You don't have to worry about a wife or a husband or children. So Paul's advice is, I think you'd be better off to just stay where you are. But Paul realizes sexual immorality is not good. That does not honor God. So his advice is, if you're a virgin and you're struggling with that, if you're engaged to an individual and you guys are not being able to stay sexually pure, get married. And here's something just completely free. And I know it's going to fly in the face of some of you and you're not going to like it, but I'm going to say it anyway. If a couple is struggling with sexual immorality, they ought not to wait a year or two or 3 years to get married. Go ahead and get married. Now, I know that flies in the face of some of you mamas who want to have a nice wedding, but if sexual immorality has crept into that relationship and sexual purity is not being maintained in that relationship, it would be better to forego the ceremony and get married than to wait for a year, two, 3 years, have a big ceremony and get married, but all the while be sleeping together. I'm saying, just me, it'd be better, go ahead and get married. Don't wait. If you're in control and you're not acting dishonorably, Paul would say, stay where you are. But if that's a problem, Scripture says, get married. Remove that from the equation because that's a deal killer. That's going to mess you up, Paul says, so don't wait. Go ahead, get married. It's not a sin to do that. Okay, that was free. One final thing, Paul says toward the end of the chapter, to widows or widowers, the Greek word for widows, same word. One word can mean either widow or widower. So I think Paul's addressing, for some reason, again, maybe to clarify it, if you're a widow, a widower, if your spouse has died, what should you do? Paul says, I'd rather you stay single. But, again, if you want to get married, if you can't control yourself, Paul says, get married. Only make sure you marry a believer. I can't imagine Paul saying to someone, yeah, just choose anybody. I think he would much rather prefer, if you're going to remarry someone since your spouse has died, marry a believer. Marry somebody who's following Jesus. Okay. A lot of stuff there. I've probably created more questions than I've answered, but best I can do in the time. Real quickly, just three or four final, very brief observations, big picture themes now that flow out of this text. Number one, if you're single, either by choice or by circumstances, you are not a second-class citizen in the kingdom. God loves you, the church should love you, and you are welcome in the kingdom of God. I think the church needs to do better in the way we treat single people. If you're a single person, I think you would likely agree with that. The church has not always honored those who choose to be single, or even those who are single not by choice but by life circumstances. Many in that category have been made, hopefully not here, but in some places have been made to feel like a second class member of the church, and that's not right. Scripture honors those, either by choice or by life circumstances, who are living a single celibate life. That is honorable, that is good, that ought to be applauded, not ridiculed or made fun of or questioned. And so my statement to you is, if you're living the single life and you're living a celibate single life by choice in particular, God honors that. That is to be applauded and admired and honored by those of us in the kingdom. Secondly, if you are married, that's a good thing too. Marriage is honorable. Marriage is good. And the sexual intimacy shared between a married couple is good. That's the way God designed it to be. A man, a woman, sexually united as one in Christ in a covenant relationship is God's design for His creation. So marriage is an honorable thing. And if you're married, fight for that marriage. Don't be looking for a way to get out of it. Be looking for a way to make it work. Do what you can to make it work. Fight for it. Don't give up on it. Don't buy into the lie that our culture says, it doesn't matter. No big deal. It is a big deal, so fight for it. Do what you can to make your marriage all that God would want it to be. Single life is honorable. The marriage life is honorable. Fight for that and uphold the other as a good thing as well. Number three, we should probably all be living with a stronger view toward the end of things than we presently are. We have come into a story that has an ending. We're going somewhere. We're going to see one day the reclamation project that God is presently carrying out come to its fruition as all is made right. We have a story that has an ending. And whether we're married or single, we don't need to get so caught up in this life that we forget about where we're going and where all of life is headed. Right? Don't get so caught up in your marriage. Don't get so caught up in being single and going and doing whatever you want to do that you forget we're part of a story that's going somewhere. And so we all probably ought to be living with a greater view of that in mind than many of us are. We're so nearsighted. We're so caught up in everything that's going on now, we sometimes lose sight of where we're going as the people of God. And that needs to be remembered too. And finally, one last thing. Wherever you are, bloom wherever you've been planted. In other words, are you single? Then let God work through you in that stage of life. Are you married? Let God work through you in that stage of life. Are you in a family that is not all that it should be? Stay there and bless that family and let God use you to be a blessing to that family. Are you in a workplace that's not everything you'd like for it to be? Bless that workplace as long as you can with the relationship you have with Christ and be a blessing to that workplace. In other words, wherever you are, bloom where you're planted. Stay where you are. Unless you're in an immoral situation or a life-threatening situation, stay where you are. Let God use you to be a blessing to other people and bloom wherever you're planted. I think Paul would encourage that. If we can help you this morning, if we can pray with you, if we can walk with you through a dark time, let us do that. We invite you. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make His face to shine upon you and give you peace.